But let me just lean in for a second on the purely financial family because it's the easiest case to think about.
Okay.
And the reason I would do that is the following. I think the go-to that a lot of families think about is their philanthropic exercise, right? And so if you, that comes back to, again, vision and purpose. If the family's fulfillment comes from how they use their wealth, not just having wealth, then you can have great success, whether it's a family enterprise or a philanthropic endeavor, because now you have something that you can point people to. And there are a couple of tools that I can lean into there for a second if you want to explore them. But
Sure.
really, the success comes from knowing that fulfillment isn't just the balance sheet.
This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, brought to you by Gold Rock Capital. Each week, we look at how high net worth families can improve their lives, decisions, and investments in a deeply uncertain world. We always aim to provide practical information, even if we can't offer specific investment advice. This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, and my name is Darren Rockman, and I'm a partner at Gold Rock Capital, the more than 20-year-old multifamily office servicing high net worth families in Israel and around the world. And welcome onto the podcast, my friend Fred Gluckman. Hey, Fred.
Hi, Darren. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Fred's coming to us from Florida, and he is a family office professional with more years' experience than. I certainly more than I do, and I think probably more than he cares to count. He's managing director of Three Wealth, which is a strategic advisory firm to ultra high net worth families. He also runs a single family office out in Pasadena. And prior to doing what he does now, he spent 15 years with the Saban Capital Group, with Chaim Saban, and prior to that, 9 years at Deloitte in California and London, doing international tax and M&A. So a really rich career. So Fred, tell us a little bit about your work over the last, you know, few decades in advising ultra high net worth families.
Well, thanks, Darren. A few decades makes me feel a little bit older than I believe I am, but I'll take that nonetheless.
Whatever, a few years, let's do that.
A few years, yeah, fair, very fair. I actually think about my career in two phases. I appreciate the two that you highlighted, and I'll use those as the anchors. One is the advisory side of it. And as you noted, Deloitte's in LA and London was really quite a fantastic set of experiences. Met a few families in some very interesting places. Spent a lot of time in Monaco and in Paris and a few other cities where ultra high net worth individuals tend to root their families and what have you. And so that was the first part of the advisory. The second part, I actually had the benefit of spending 2 years as a partner at EY in the Family Office Advisory Services team. And that's actually been quite the most recent experience before the current family office. Really gave me an opportunity to meet some very, very, very interesting families, many of them with touches into Israel and to many other countries. So that was quite a really meaningful and impactful place. I was able to crystallize a whole lot of thoughts that have gone into Three Wealths even today. And the other part of the career span was, as you noted, the operational part. So 15 years working with Saban Capital Group had me with some very interesting negotiations. I picked up a fair amount of Hebrew skills along the way, learned some words that I didn't know. Mostly
really
from taxi cab drivers,
I'm sure. Yeah.
Yes, quite, and a little Arabic as well, but only the more colorful words. And then one other family office here in Pasadena that we're working to empower them and empower their legacy as well. So those are really the two, I guess, streams of experience over the past couple of decades as opposed to a few decades.
Couple of decades. Okay. But we're going to agree on a couple of decades. That's going to be the
fair.
That's the negotiated position. So you've really seen a wide range of families. And I suspect that you've seen some of them who have been very successful in both managing the family aspect and the wealth that they have. And my guess is you've probably seen some that have been less successful. So what are the critical success factors? What are the things that make the process of managing a family and its wealth work?
Yeah, great question. And it really is what is the underlying premise that my wife and I have behind Three Wealths, which are the following three elements: family, finance, and fulfillment. at the end of the day, I'll go to the middle one first, because that's, I think, the most common factor that a lot of the audience would be thinking about. And certainly that's what is a huge enabler, and that is the finance. Do they have enough financial wealth to really look multi-generationally and have a certain amount of patient capital underneath that which they are stewarding? So if you've got that, then that enables or gives you a certain amount of freedom, I would think, to think more broadly. And that really gets into then what are the success drivers. So the first is the family. And what is it that binds that family together? What is the vision? What are the values that the family really holds core to? And is the leading generation and the leadership of the family really pursuing that and driving alignment amongst the family? That's really, without that sense of values, the valuables, the financial part, it'll disappear. So you've got to have that. Yeah. And now what's fulfillment? So fulfillment isn't merely the accumulation of wealth. It is, what are you doing with it? And does that tie back to that value set that you as a family have designed and identified as the really, really the core driver?
Right. And you know, the process of articulating those values and the process of getting consensus around those values, sometimes in you know, when you're talking about larger numbers of people, often many of which have very different views about what's important in the world. How have you seen families successfully do that?
Yeah. And that's then the magic, right? So it's great. And you can draw an analogy to business if you want, when you talk about, you know, vision and mission statements and what have you. So how do you operationalize that vision part? How do you operationalize that dream part, if you will? Okay, so now let's get into the tacticals. So there are a couple of things that I really start to think about. And where, again, to your question, what do the successful families do? One is around what are the structures and how frequently do we reinforce and visit those? It sounds a little bit clinical the way I share that out, but think about your family vacation. Do you bring everybody together? Are you all sitting on the beach, or do you actually come together in some kind of forum from time to time and talk about these values and how are we doing against them? And what are we doing to get to realize them? Do we have people in the family that we've charged with being able to lead that element? And are they convening folks around it from time to time to actually reinforce and make that a living element of it? So get together, talk about it, engage people, and don't be the single controlling individual. Give other people some responsibility, give them the vision, and then enable them and empower them to go and pursue that with everybody else. So one is that. And then the other is, let's have a really good trust and estate plan to make sure that they've got the wealth underneath it over time.
Right.
Because otherwise, you know, it may disappear because we don't steward it well. It could also disappear because we've shared too much with the government or not really thought about where it needs to land in the long term.
Yeah. How have you seen, you know, there's this tension, I think, in many families between the sort of dominant, controlling, very often the wealth creator, and, you know, his or her vision, often his vision for, you know, the way the family should be and what it should do. And then the other stakeholders, the children, the grandchildren. Have you seen families successfully share a vision across generations? And have you seen families maybe fail at doing so?
Yeah, both of those. So there's a couple of ways to think about that. One is, are we just a financial family, or do we have an enterprise?
Right.
If we're just a financial family, it becomes very, very difficult, because that's really the dynamism of an entrepreneur. That's the dynamism of a singular, highly charismatic individual. If that's the case, you kind of want to pivot a little differently. If you have an enterprise, it's probably a little bit easier because you've got somebody you can bring into an operating business and they can be mentored along the way in very, very, in a much more structured manner. And I think that's probably where you see the companies like SC Johnson in the US, or any number of family enterprises in Israel, of course, that we see that as well. But let me just lean in for a second on the purely financial family, because it's the easiest case to think about.
Okay.
And the reason I would do that is the following. I think the go-to that a lot of families think about is their philanthropic exercise.
Yeah.
Right. And so if you, that comes back to, again, vision and purpose. If the family's fulfillment comes from how they use their wealth, not just having wealth, then you can have great success, whether it's a family enterprise or a philanthropic endeavor, because now you have something that you can point people to. And there are a couple of tools that I can lean into there for a second if you want to explore them. Sure. But really, the success comes from knowing that fulfillment isn't just the balance sheet.
Yeah. Go for it. Give me a couple of examples.
Yeah. So there's this idea of a family bank that I've been working through, and some families have adopted in various different ways. And we've used this as a tool where perhaps the family enterprise doesn't exist. So what's a family bank? Again, it's three pillars, and it comes back to family finance and fulfillment. So families have really, entrepreneurs in particular, have three core assets. They have a social asset, they have an intellectual asset, and they have a dollar sheet, a balance sheet, a shekel sheet asset, right? So if you are thinking about your youngest generations having some type of entrepreneurial spirit, then have three accounts that those family members can draw from. They can draw from the numbers. They can draw from your social balance sheet. Who do you know that can help them be successful and then make that part of the family? Mm-hmm. And as they think about their own business plan, are you available as a resource to help them think that out? Can they make a withdrawal of your intellect? And if you make a condition that they have to deposit more than they withdraw, then the family stays together, because they look at it as a collective pot that everybody can draw from and everyone can contribute to.
Right. Excellent. That's a really interesting way of thinking about it. You know, one of the things that we've seen, and my guess is that you've seen, in making sure those types of dialogues, that type of dialogue can happen, is the importance of education and some of the challenges around the unevenness of education, often because of different levels of interest, but also different levels of ability. You know, what have you seen really well-structured, thoughtful families? What have they done in this area?
And again, grounded in the same underlying premise, right? So there's the education that's the formal education. If you have an entrepreneurial spirit, if the family doesn't have an intellectual depth in their family bank around that, find somebody who does. So pivot, if you will, to the social balance sheet. Who do we know who can educate in that space and bring that and make that available and encourage the family member on behalf of the family writ larger to go and pursue it? So lean into this balance of formal and informal education in a way that is an enabler for success at every single term. Use your social network to actually do that. Use your intellectual capacity to understand that it's a driver, and tie it back to, again, what are the vision and values of the family in the aggregate. And as long as all that stays integrated, phenomenal success. So what's an example of that? There is a family that I worked with for a very, very long period of time. And one of the younger generation members wanted to be an artist. That's all they wanted to do in the world. Like, the family doesn't have a history in art, but that's what the family member wants to do. So what do? They say, okay, fine. We know somebody at XYZ school, in this situation that happened to be a nice conservatory in New York. And they said, go meet somebody who's running that particular school and really figure out, does this mean something to you? They go into an audition. Mm-hmm. The young child performs. The person that they knew who was high up at the university said, oh, that's a phenomenal voice, but it ain't quite as good as you think it is. Right?
Tough message.
Right? Tough message. But then that family member had at least an honest reaction from somebody who was desperately well qualified in the space. They got an expert opinion. They got expert feedback. And that family member was able to come back and say, okay, what else can I do? Well, then the family said, okay, well, here's somebody who runs a not-for-profit that actually works in the arts. Go work with them. So they were able to take this family member and walk them around other elements of the industry And that young family member was able to decide something very well defined, leveraging the family's knowledge that says, you're not going to be a recording star, but you can be involved in the industry and be impactful. And that young child happens to be flourishing right now.
Fantastic. Well, that's a great story. One of the challenges that we've come across amongst family members, particularly at that intersection between family and finance, and I'll put it in these terms, is the fear of looking stupid or the fear of not understanding. How do I go to a family meeting and ask a question that, you know, I don't understand what, I don't know, you know, a discount rate is or, you know, a tax rate is? Have you seen families deal with this?
Yeah, absolutely. Two angles on that. You may notice a theme for me, Darren. I kind of try to approach things from a couple of different mindsets. Good. One comes back to your formal education, right? If you have somebody who, if you will, sponsors family member development on the intellectual side, and you put somebody at the core of that, and maybe it's the matriarch, and maybe it's the patriarch, and maybe it's somebody different, who knows? But somebody who's coordinating that element of the family bank, the intellectual side, right, should also, in a successful model, and this is something that I'm building out right now, actually, is what's the baseline that everybody needs to be able to speak to on a core family element so that we can have a great conversation and nobody feels inadequate. So we're developing right now, and this is also something within 3Wells, some educational modality. And a lot of banks do this. A lot of wealth advisors do this. Some people do it casually. Some people do it formally. Northern Trust has a phenomenal formal program. Kellogg, Wharton, Stanford, any number of schools. Columbia has an amazing wealth management program that family members can go into if they want to sit in a classroom and learn not just ROI. Maybe they want to learn, you know, Greek letter analyses on alphas and betas and whatever you may think on that analysis. If you want to go deep. The others, you could just sit down with a wealth planner, make that available, and talk about cash flows and budgeting basics. As a family office professional, I do this with young members and even co-generationalists who might not be expert in this space. And you're just right. You just want to spend the time. So that's number one. Number two is within your family forum, make it safe. There are no stupid questions. If you're a great facilitator, you'll take the question that you may think or that person may think may be too simple. As a facilitator, as the mentor, as the entrepreneur, as the sponsor of the family, make it okay for somebody to ask that question and turn it into something that grows. I can give you an example of that in a couple of seconds if you want, but yeah, that's really, it's about, so somebody asks, to your point, an overly simplistic question. Give me one that you have in mind if you've got something top of mind.
How much tax am I likely to pay over the next 5 years?
That's a great question. All right. So here's how tax works. First of all, you want to pay taxes, because if you don't have money and you're not making money, then you're not paying taxes. So let's make it okay to pay taxes. You pay taxes because you're making money. That's our job. So we make money. So first of all, it's okay. Let's make that safe. Second of all, let's talk about that. As a family, we make most of our money off of investing. So we pay taxes based on how much money we bring in on a cash basis. If you've got your separate business, let's sit down and talk about that separately. And we'll create an opportunity for you to understand that on a detailed level. So tie it back to the family. Here's what all of us find relevant from your question. Make it okay for that person to go pursue it separately. And we'll get you some formal education to deal with you as an individual.
So as you say, make it a safe environment and then give them an out so that the question can be dealt with, can be validated, and can be explained in a way that they can understand.
Exactly. So nobody needs to worry about having to be the smartest person in the room. That's a dangerous space. Everybody can feel okay and feel safe that the family's got them. It's a safety net also.
Moving slightly away from values and you know, I call it the touchy-feely stuff, but it's so important that makes it sound, that's probably the wrong way to put it. What about the sort of harder bits, you know, data, controls, things of that nature?
Yeah.
What do successful families do there? I hope that's not too a simplistic a question.
It's a great question. Let's tie it back. So again, it's a dynamic question. There's four real motivators to how families control their information and really whether or not they do it by bringing people in to hyper-control it,
yeah,
or being okay having an advisor hold it. Risk, privacy, control, and cost. All right. So what are the great, the strongest controls? Pencil, paper, and a safe. If you want nobody else to see it, it's just going to take you a really long time to figure out how you guys are doing on a wealth curve basis. So that you gotta, you know, and everybody is going to tell you that you don't want to spend the money to insource and build something custom. So what are great controls? Great controls are make sure that anybody you're trusting gives you key performance data and a validation regularly.
Yeah.
Two, have a mechanism to double check that. No matter how much you trust somebody over time, it's not you. So have somebody you trust, know who they're working with, and have a direct channel to that other party. So let's be very specific about this. How's my balance sheet doing? You've got somebody in my situation, let's say I'm the CFO of something, right? I'm going to come to you every week with something and every month with something. And here's how you're doing. And if you call me up, you're going to ask me a specific question. I'm going to give you a specific answer.
Yep.
Every once in a while, go sit down with who I'm working with. Make sure you know them and they know you. And you've made it very clear to that person, you're in charge. So that's in a situation where you're going to trust an outside party and you're going to trust an inside party. You've got a balance on your privacy. You've got a balance on your controls. And you've got a risk awareness that says that I've got relationships, not just with my my own employee or my own head of my family office, if I've got a family office.
Or my accountant or whoever.
With my auditor, with my accountant, with my wealth manager. Darren, if you're you guys are managing the platform, you know the principal, not just the family office person.
Sure. Okay. What about making sure that data is secure and making sure that family members treat that, you know, that data in the most appropriate way? Strong passwords, you know, making sure that they don't write their password and save it on the desktop of their laptop, which unfortunately, you know, so many people do. I don't, but so many people do.
Yeah, so leading practices are everything that you just articulated just there, which is strong passwords changed on a regular basis that are unique to you, passphrases with numbers and characters, all of those things that are the leading practices are absolutely things that one should do on an ongoing basis. There are a number of services. Apple's got a native service for it. Google's got a native service for it. There are companies like LastPass who would do all of those things.
Yep.
LifeLock, whatever. Follow those procedures. Number two, social media, greatest risk of all. Multi-generational families where you've got younger generations who aren't necessarily aware of what's going on. Social media can be your greatest leak. By the way, story. Youngest generation goes out and is having a great time on some vacation, posting pictures over and over again. Mom and dad show up in the background.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who's looking to do something bad to that family now knows that that entire family's out of town.
Yep.
And that person has a window of time in which they can act. Terrible, terrible, terrible risk. Yep. How do you teach that to the youngest generation? How do you create an experience for them to really lock at home? Whether it's TikTok or Snap or whatever it is that they're publicizing, hard to do. So we're going to tell everybody the leading practices, the things that we just talked about at the very, very beginning. And yet over time, challenging to manage. So change your password that much more often.
Yeah.
Because that's the compensating. Quick other story. You talked about passwords left on pieces of paper. And you talk about how do you manage controls. So every once in a while, I would have an outside security firm come through and do a sweep of the office at night. Mm-hmm. And I get a report the next morning. They would have taken pictures. The number of times that I had pictures presented to me showing Post-it notes taped to a computer screen. Yes, literally on the screen with the password.
Of course. That's the safest place to keep it, Fred. Don't you know that?
Of course. And by the way, the cleaning crew who's coming through at night isn't going to see that the moment they walk in the door.
No. Yeah, that's right. Look, you know, you and I have attended an excellent family office conference together a number of occasions. And the data security session, which I love attending every time, they always ask the same two questions. Who takes data security seriously? And everybody puts their hand up. And then who uses open Wi-Fi at hotels and airports? And two-thirds of the room put their hand up. And the security guys go, are you out of your mind? Are you nuts? So, yeah, okay. You've been a trusted advisor to families for a long time now. How do the smart families get the most out of you?
Other than thumb screws?
Other than thumb screws, yeah. Well, we can just generalize other than torture devices, you know, not just thumb screws.
Two things. One is that safe space, that it's okay to work through a complicated question together, right? And to build on each other's question to come to a better outcome.
Yeah.
And so your example earlier about the family member not wanting to look foolish in front of the rest of the family, if you create an environment where your advisor is concerned about looking foolish, then all they're going to do is play defense. And long-term gold families don't play defense. You have to make it okay to have an open dialogue to ask the question, because if you're the principal, you probably have been thinking about whatever your question is a lot longer than the person you're asking.
Sure.
You probably also been looking at a lot more information than the person you're asking. So number one, if you're going to do it on the spot, make it safe to ask questions, make it safe to walk into things, make it safe to build. But if you really want to get the best out of your trusted advisor, let them know your agenda before you meet and make sure that they themselves are out in the market. You referenced a conference, and I'll name it. You and I have had the fortune to go to the Citibank's Family Office Leadership Program. And being able to attend leading edge, top thinking, top presenting seminars and sending your trusted advisors and making sure that they go and gather that data, critical to breaking down the risk of echo chamber, the risk of peer validation, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah. In investing in your advisor is always a good thing, because you're going to get much.
And holding them accountable for making sure that they are themselves going out and tapping into the markets, make it a success parameter.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I'm going to finish off with a sort of general question on the investment side of things, because we've talked about finance and we haven't touched on portfolio and portfolio allocation. You know, we're in a world which is volatile. We're in a world which continues to be definitely uncertain. Excuse the pun. how have you seen the successful families, the thoughtful families, approach this issue of portfolio allocation? Well, you know, key do's and don'ts, if you will.
Yeah. I'm glad we're wrapping on this question, because I think it allows us to bring the whole exercise together quite nicely. First, have a long vision. Know that success is something that's achieved over the total horizon, not just in a particular economic cycle, and certainly not in a particular year's annual returns. If you have that very, very long vision, then really as a family, you've got the ability to take a conviction about each economic cycle as it turns around, right? If we look at what moves a market from time to time, really oftentimes what brings a downturn in a market is something that was swept under the rug in the last upturn. And then whatever disruptors have happened in that period of time and some kind of macro set of trends that are looking at where the market's going to go in the future based on the overarching economy. So take that moment in an economic reset to take a view on what's going to happen in the next cycle and lean into that in some way, shape, or form. So if you believe in healthcare as a long-term trend, find somebody who's genius in healthcare, find a family member who has a passion about it, and go have that family member do research and get involved and take a conviction in it. Yeah. And balance out your portfolio, if we're talking about portfolio returns, in a way that says we're going to be able to take a total economic cycle here because we can take some risk, and then have some amount of your portfolio that just meets the basics along the way, and realize that you're taking a 100-year view here, you're not taking a 1-year returns view. Yeah. And realize and set that as a parameter for your family bank and for your family vision, that your finances can support the fulfillment on behalf of the whole exercise by using it as opportunity and not merely as some time to go into malaise and self-reflection and whatever.
Yeah. And I suppose I would only add to that excellent summary by saying, you know, learn from what you've done in the past, but don't necessarily think that repeating it is the right way to go.
Oh, for sure.
Okay, so
there are a number of philosopher quotes you can lean into that one.
That's right. Yeah, you know, history and all that stuff.
All that.
Let me sort of try and summarize what you've said. You know, the sort of success factors for families are values, above and beyond anything else. Good governance and education, preparing the next generation and validating them. Maintaining good data, good controls over your trusted advisors, and securing yourself, trying to avoid the echo chamber, and supporting and encouraging your trusted advisors to educate and network and bring in best practice from the outside, and think in the long term when it comes to the portfolio and managing your wealth, and don't get caught up in the news and the cycle, but try and get above that.
You make it sound like we covered a lot of ground.
Hey, we did. And I'm sure that there's a lot more that we could cover, but Fred, I'm not going to take up any more of your time. You've been incredibly generous with us so far. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciate it as well. It's always great to see you.
It's great to see you too. And until the next time I see you, either this side of the world or your side of the world, thanks very, very much. And thank you everybody for listening, and look out for more episodes coming soon. Fred Gluckman, thank you, and goodbye.